Welcome to Season 2 of Assessment in Focus, the podcast from Inspira, where we invite our guests to share their insights on assessment transformation, innovation, and enhancement. My guest on this episode is Professor Ian Pickup from the Open University. Ian is Pro Vice Chancellor Students at the Open University, where he leads work to enhance student experience, engagement, and employability, and access for a diverse student body. His portfolio includes the Student Voice, delivery of high-quality learning and teaching with a strong focus on inclusion and removing barriers to success. Ian's also a National Teaching Fellow, a Principal Fellow of the Higher Education Academy, and a Professor of the Student Experience in Higher Education. And Ian, I am most glad that you've come on to be a episode on this podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Ish. It's good to
Ian,
be.
Ian, I've got some questions for you. And I'm going to start with us looking to where we are now and perhaps into the future. What do you currently see as the most promising innovation in assessment?
Well, what a great question to start with, Ish. Thank you. And I think my headline here is that the future of assessment can't be and isn't going to be, and we're seeing really positive signals that it won't be, just more surveillance. And for me, it's about more authenticity. And that's something that we'll probably return to during this conversation. Now, of course, assessment has always been central to the endeavour of higher education. But I think we are at a particular moment where we're all being forced to rethink what this looks like much more fundamentally. And for me, the promise within that, the promise of innovation, isn't any particular tool or platform. It's a shift in mindset. And that shift in mindset from assessment of a product at the end of a learning journey to one of really focusing on the learning process. So in that respect, you know, the age that we're working through this, you know, AI has really exposed something that we kind of already knew, that assessment just built on recall, routine production, or simple generation of an answer is no longer enough. And I think the opportunity that we're seeing people embrace, you know, globally, is now focused much more clearly on how students think, how they're actually learning, that process of learning and application of knowledge, how they exercise judgment, and how they can demonstrate their learning in their context with us. And I think that's really promising.
Do you feel that perhaps this is perhaps an unfair question, and perhaps I'm suggesting an unfair advantage. Do you feel that given the context of the Open University, which for I'm sure our worldwide audience understands and knows about, but maybe you could just help them, anyone who hasn't, with what your student body looks like. Do you think you perhaps have an unfair advantage in your student body and their overall life experience in making it easier to contextualize for them, because so many of them have got real life experience and are learners in their lifelong journey rather than necessarily being weighted towards that 18, 19 category?
Yeah, great question. I would say I've previously worked in four other campus-based universities. So, and I think what I said above applies in all of those contexts equally. But you're right, the Open University is a particular context. You know, just to give a bit of background, The open means various things, including open access. So our students don't need to have prior qualifications to start their undergraduate qualifications with us. And we operate at significant scale through supported open distance learning. And when we say scale, we've currently, you know, have around 200,000 for shorthand students on the books, as it were, across the different levels, including very many in partner organisations through validated partnerships. So scale is part of what we do. It's the essence of what we do, reaching more people to help them access higher education for the transformative benefits that come with that is at the heart of our university mission and always has been from the founding days. Now the interesting thing is most people when we talk about the Open University have an Open University student in their mind. They can picture them and maybe traditionally and certainly originally it was older learners, perhaps have missed the opportunity for higher education first time round, maybe with lots of negative experiences in compulsory education, leading towards them going straight into the workplace, for example. And I have to say, yes, we still have those students on our books, and they're fabulous, and they bring rich life experience, and include those who are looking to upskill and reskill, if I can include those bits of jargon into this answer as well. But increasingly, our student body is getting younger. One of our highest entry groups in the autumn for the last couple of years has been in the 18 to 24 year old group, including those who are deciding that actually, be able to work whilst I study, stay in my existing context, not have to move away from home and take on additional costs that come with all of that, is appealing. So we are, we talk about being a five or six generation university. From a student perspective, increasingly as we're waiting for Generation Alpha to start to arrive, but also as a staff body. So our staff equally are across the lifespan in that sense. So part of what we're thinking really hard about at the moment is delivery of open education at scale, how we best personalise in that scaled context, which is both, could be the holy grail for many, many institutions.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely the right thing for us to be focused on. But also, I guess, reshaping what we understand by lifelong education. And there was a version of lifelong education in 1969 when the OU was founded. And there's perhaps a slightly different conceptualization of that now for the 21st century. And we're very much in that space.
Yeah, I can well remember being a child in the early 80s and the mid 80s, and BBC Two on a Sunday morning being the open university broadcast. So it's very different to how it is now. I wanted to also pick up on your point about authenticity, because I've been looking recently at this spectrum of authenticity that exists. Look. And when people talk about authenticity, we get, I think, the same examples repeatedly, which is a law student doing something a lawyer would do, or an accountant doing something an accountancy student doing something an accountant would do. Let's take the harder end of that wedge. Where do you see authenticity from the perspective of, for example, a history student? What's the authentic assessment? And I'm not asking you for the answer that everyone influences, but what's your view on how we do it where the degrees don't have that intrinsic tie, as we see it, with post-university, but of course have that wider benefit of preparing somebody for society and all of the benefits that higher education brings? How do we make those more authentic?
Yeah. So I mean, first of all, authenticity for me includes the examples you've just been given. That's something that I can take into my future careers across the lifespan. But it also includes the importance of being authentic to the individual, to my context, to my place in the world, to my view of the world, and crucially, to my goals. And I think as a sector, I've applied for a particular course as a signal for what a student's goal might be.
Right.
Underpinning that might be a goal that's about changing my life, changing the life of me and my kids, change the life of me and others in my community, changing the world. And so to be authentic in that sense, as well as being relevant to my future career across the next 60 years, when actual skills and the need for the what will change, beyond recognition as they have in our working lives, there's that underpinning set of skills, competencies, attributes, all of those words that all disciplines in a higher education level should be encouraging, should be enabling, should be teaching, and indeed should be assessing. So to the history undergrad, who do go on to have fabulous careers and make impact, of course, from those experiences, it's competences and attributes like critical thinking. It's those transferable skills. And increasingly in the world of technology, we need ever more people to be really good at being a human. There's of course various frameworks for that. I love the framework that's come out of MIT. It's called it's EPOCH, EPOCH, which is an acronym for various human skills. And I think, you know, how we ensure that our teaching, our learning, and the assessment of that learning can embrace those attributes and skills is really important. And at the moment, would certainly include a focus on critical AI literacy. Not just being able to use AI, which of course is important, in whichever sector one goes into beyond graduation, but it's that ability to discern, to have a set of values that we can use to judge, to be responsible, to be ethical, and to apply that knowledge and understanding in my future context, whatever that context might be. So it's not simple. The word authentic is sometimes taken as it's a lab report, it's writing something for a museum, back to the history student, in a way that a job of today might need. But the deeper meaning to for me is it's more individualized about my own context and my goals. And it's that broad set of human skills to take into whichever career comes for me.
I couldn't agree more. Regular listeners and viewers of this podcast will know that I am anti-essay or closed book, silent essay, safe where we need to, because I don't see the authenticity in it. It's not a way that I think people work. Not to bin it completely, because there probably is context for it, but it's overused. But I'm really delighted to hear that wider application of authenticity as a way that we should be thinking about it. And as we talk about the sorts of changes that we foresee and that we think should happen, it takes me to my second question, which is, where is the real barrier to assessment change right now? In policy, in systems, in our habits, what's preventing this change or slowing it down?
Yeah. Well, I think the honest answer is all of the above. All of the things that you've mentioned. It isn't just one of policy. Now, policy matters. It really does. Institutional systems matter. They help us get the job done. But if I had to identify the deepest barrier, I would probably say it's, I think how you phrase it, our own habits. And I don't mean that necessarily in a really negative way, because, you know, policy and systems often reflect what academics and institutions have become as the norm, and help us be rigorous and legitimate and have real integrity. And we found ways of doing those things with really, really good intention over a long period of time across whole careers and more. So I guess, but many assessment practices feel deeply embedded, not because they are necessarily now, here we are in 2026, as the best possible approaches, but they have become familiar and potentially culturally comfortable.
Yes.
And there's another but here, which is, and of course, some of that is discipline-based, you know, whichever discipline you view the world from and your career has been based in, there's a way of doing that is now the accepted norm. And at a really deep level, that cuts to individual identity as an academic, as a community, as a member of a community of practice. So, of course, it's challenging when we're asked to think of different ways of doing. Whether that's because of the advent of new technologies like generative AI or other changes, it cuts to the heart of what I know to be an academic in my area, as an expert in my area, with years of practice where students have graduated. We've had robust and sometimes, you know, laborious processes built to ensure academic integrity and quality and so on. But you know, the technology, the AI in particular, has made this hard to ignore. So I do think we do need policy reform, and yes, undoubtedly we need better systems. We know that only too well here at the AU. Back to our scale, our distance learning, we rely on systems, and of course, systems at scale are also very expensive to do really really well. But the deeper challenge is whether we're actually prepared to think differently, to challenge those deep assumptions about learning, about knowledge production, about evidencing what I know, and ultimately about achievement for accreditation. So I guess the question is not about just about asking students what they know in university, but it's how they can use knowledge responsibly, critically, effectively. And how on earth can all of that be demonstrated in some of our really traditional approaches to assessment? I just don't think it can be achieved unless we see significant change. And because of the OU scale and because of our distance and reliance on digital, we can't really hide behind tradition. We have to build proactively, deliberately, build approaches that are inclusive and resilient enough for the real world in which we're in and our students are in. And that does require cultural change as much as technical change.
Absolutely. That cultural change, I think the academic or the higher education equivalent of no one was criticized for buying IBM is no exams officer is going to say to you no if you want a traditional 3-hour exam on campus or a coursework with a 2-hour, 2-hour, 2-week turnaround. So yeah, that I put this proposition out there that as well as the cultural change we need and the process change, there needs to be a greater sense of enablement for those change makers to do something different. If people are seen in higher education on the edges where they're doing something outside of our 3-hour exam, 2-week coursework, I think that's as much the problem. We see them on the edges. That should become more mainstream and there should be a greater chance to enable it. That of course is me speaking. I don't have to make that happen. You do. So tell me, is that actually a possibility, or am I just too sort of lofty in the ambitions of somebody who
No,
doesn't
it
make it
is.
happen?
Of course, it's a possibility. I think it would be foolish for any of us to think it can be achieved in a linear way, that it can be a once and done. We'll rifle through the curriculum, we'll change everything once, and then it's all good. This is not one of those things.
No, not at all.
Not, so this is going to be an evolution. I think there's going to be back and forth. There's going to be mess. There already is messiness. And so as an example, three years ago, like every institution, we worked out a way of responding to the freely available Gen AI tools. We came up with some approaches to assessment in light of that. We gave guidance to students and staff, and we got on with it. But through the work we've done in the last 3 years, we've got a very active community of practice focused on assessment, academic integrity, and the impact of AI. We've actually just recently gone back to our Senate body in the university to redefine a set of principles. 26, knowing what we know now compared to what we knew in 2022, 2023, we've reshaped our approach and set the course for the next year of things that we're gonna evolve. And I'm sure in a year's time, 2 years' time, 5 years' time, we'll be going backwards and forwards again, as we're all making sense of knowledge and learning and assessment in this era where technology is moving quickly, and where our understanding of how we can apply that technology and how our students are applying that technology changes almost daily. So that's challenging, and it's challenging, which cuts back to the previous point around academic identity, where colleagues rightly feel that they're the experts in teaching, learning, assessment in their subject. This is how we've done it. But this is how we've done it might not be the way we need to do it this year, and again the year after, and the year after that. So, and I suppose in the sector, but perhaps not the most agile and the most flexible, and the most, we don't have the best preparedness to work in that iterative way, I don't think. But we're going to have to do things differently.
Well, that neatly takes us on to the third question, which is in 5 years' time, which is my way of booking your diary in 5 years' time for a follow-up podcast, but certainly more
Yeah, I'll be
interesting.
there, don't worry. Yeah.
Thank you. But let's fast forward 5 years' time. What would you hope had genuinely changed in assessment? You've told us a bit about what it takes to get there. What do you hope will have changed? And I'm just going to weave in a bit of what you've just said into this question too, which is, yes, there's that back and forth. How do we keep the momentum going? Because knowing that it's an iterative process can also sometimes lead to, well, next year in that case. So where would you hope we'd be? How do we get there?
Yeah, so I think as a headline answer, if we're really serious about inclusion in our learning, teaching, and assessment practices, assessment in 5 years' time won't be built around a narrow model of legitimacy, or there'll be a much broader sweep of approaches to assessment in play. Whether including formative and summative, including some aspects that are human to human, some aspects that are using technology, including, for example, being assessed within virtual environments. So I would see a broader range of assessment strategies in play, and therefore the diet of assessment for an individual student would be broader. In that sense, I also hope we'll have stopped treating assessment somewhat of a fixed ritual, and started to treat it across the board as a dynamic part of learning design. It's back to that process product difference, and I think assessment just being part of learning design becomes more exciting, more with more possibility. And I would hope to see that we get institutions that are more agile, responsive, and change ready, not to make one-off adjustments, but just the start of this era of ongoing evolution. Back to earlier question around process and systems, validations, and at the OU, that's a big part of our work is what we call production. We produce amazing multimedia resources
Yes.
to support delivery, to support our tuition model, which takes time, it takes expertise, and a lot of cost is built into our approach. So once that course is live in delivery, in presentation, as we would say, making changes on the hoof becomes a little bit tricky. But we're going to have to find ways. We're going to have to find ways where we can adjust, alter, introduce new ways. Of course, whilst also keeping an eye on our regulators. By the way, we're also a four-nation university, so we don't just have the Office for Students, although we work in line with the Office for Students' responsibilities, but also with our funders and regulatory bodies in the other four nations of the United Kingdom. And the other group that I think a broad connection to is really important here is our professional statutory and other bodies and societies, subject royal societies and so on, who have their own view of legitimacy and integrity and what counts in terms of knowledge and how students can show that knowledge. And I think we need those partners and stakeholders to be in these conversations with us, to also be agile, flexible, responsive in this age of always having to think about learning design, not as a once and done within my career approach. And I think there's one last thing that I would hope we'll see as part of that is as all institutions in the sector, and indeed the school and college sectors as well, being better at designing assessments that are useful beyond that immediate act of grading. Assessments that develop judgment, confidence, capability, readiness for what comes next, which again, back to an earlier part of this conversation, shorthand, skills and capabilities, attributes. But I think it's deeper than that. It's about my readiness as a learner for my 60 plus years of life in the world, beyond my, time spent studying and showing you what I know. And part of that might be, the bottom line for that might be us all being better at helping students be what we could call master learners, being able to learn now and into the future, and show that in different ways. And I think we have a really big responsibility to help all of our learners beyond that, not just getting a grade component part of a university experience.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And for a long time, my happy place, the place where I'd like to see us get to, is probably particularly at level six, level seven, so for our international audience, final year undergraduate and into postgraduate, is one where we're saying to the learner, here are the learning outcomes. You go away and produce the things that demonstrate that you've met them. We previously talked about assessment literacy being part of the requirement to that happening. But as I engage with more and more people, and a lot of your answers today have demonstrated that our change in the sector also has to happen to show those possibilities. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know the ways of being assessed or showing your knowledge, skills, and understanding, and that being interwoven with your learning until you see examples of it. And maybe as we do more of the change that you've set out, maybe it's not a level six, level seven ambition. Actually, there's micro examples of it as we go through. One of the things that has always fascinated me is the way that students interact with their feedback and what they see from it. I know from my own teaching practice, the stark difference between the students who would pore over every word as soon as they got it, versus the ones who'd scoop it up and put it in their bag. And because I taught advocacy and they got feedback from me immediately, I got to see the response to the feedback, which was great.
Yeah.
Which, as I've said before, often was, I can't read your handwriting, but that's a different point.
Okay.
We've spent a long time improving how we give feedback. And I think every university probably has an acronym that sits in front of a model of how feedback should be given. What are we still misunderstanding about how students use that feedback?
So I think you're right. Students use feedback in lots of different ways. But of course, how they receive feedback is it's a condition the university creates. And I have to say, a little plug-in for the Open University here is, consistently our model has really sector-leading student feedback around our approach to assessment and feedback. And that in part we know is because of our model, which is based on, quite big chunky modules with regular rhythms, a regular pulse of assessment throughout the module, with an end of module assessment as well. But because of the way our tutor marked assessments, our TMAs are structured, there's those regular opportunities for rich feedback from our brilliant tutors to our amazing students. So our students are just used to receiving feedback at really regular intervals and making use of that feedback for what comes next. And I think where we have models in the sector where we don't have that regular rhythm, then the conditions of receiving feedback come at the end of a modular or in the qualification journey, by which time, of course, it's too late to make a difference about what I show next in that particular module. So, but of course, that's not the student's fault. And I think we also have to understand something I said earlier about student goals, student goals in their context. The vast majority of our students at the Open University, whichever generation they're in, are working, working and caring with a disability, and have busy lives, often complex lives. And so we have to provide the feedback in a way that acknowledges that, in a way that is relatively straightforward to receive and consume and act upon and understand, with opportunities for checking what that feedback might mean. So I can, in my quite limited time in some cases, use that to move forward. You know, it's feeding forward, not feeding back, and all of those things. So that there shouldn't be any surprises when a student gets the grade ultimately in you know that there shouldn't be a lack of understanding of what I need to do next to keep myself on track to get where I would like to be. And you know, feedback is one of the most powerful parts of learning when it is genuinely developmental. You know, and by that I mean examples where feedback helps the penny to drop. You know, moments of liminality, you know, wrestling with a tricky concept, or whatever level of study. You know, feedback is part of that scaffolding I need to move through that aha moment, and I've got it, and I can now move on to that next concept. So the feedback, that relationship with the person giving feedback, it is a central part of how, as humans, we can learn and we can develop. And that's the same in thinking about academic assessment as it is in thinking about performance on the sports field or in the arts. You know, feedback from the coach, from the tutor, from the advisor is absolutely crucial. So I think, you know, it's whilst it is important that feedback is timely, and most institutions will have a KPI around how quickly students receive feedback. You know, it's more about the centrality of it in the learning process and, you know, enabling students, teaching students actually to use feedback as part of the process rather than just as part of the post-mortem at the end of that learning journey is absolutely crucial. But that's on us. That's on us to create those conditions, knowing what we know about our students, if that makes sense, and not being too critical. But when we see students who lead busy and complex lives, you know, rushing to get to that end point, but the joy is in that the check and challenge aspect of feedback and feed forward to help us all learn.
I'm going to take the bit that you just mentioned there at the end about the busy lives of the students. I think the most common thing I hear when we talk about feedback from academics is, I agree with everything that's being said. I too have a busy life. A life. How do we better enable academics to have the space and time to provide that high quality feedback? It seems. Because for all of the reasons you mentioned, it often comes at the end if it's not done in the right way, and so it just is seen as this big ball of work I have to do as grade justification, and it's not then meeting the point of feeding forward. What's the as a place with sector leading feedback? What are the things people can do to really enable their academics to have the space to do what they all want to do in any event?
Yeah, no, and the vast majority of academics who are engaging in teaching and learning know all this, that they know the centrality, the importance of a provision of feedback, which needn't be necessarily writing pages and pages of comments or margin notes. So, you know, of course we acknowledge it's about workload, and but therefore institutions stepping back and really thinking about the model. What is our operating model for teaching and learning and assessment? And sometimes models, operating models for this, for workforce management, tools that put so much time into a formula to say, well, you've got this many students, these many scripts to mark, that's these many hours. And it's never enough. It's in the formula. Because of this desire to spend time, importantly, on feedback. So it's making sure, taking a moment as an institution to think about our model of delivery. Have we got enough of a focus on these moments of assessment and feedback in the model? Or is it the model that's wrong, where we've just got so many minutes per script at the end of the module to account for, you know, a colleague, you know, wading through script after script against the clock. And I think it's how we can best build it in to account for the importance of it, whilst also, of course, supporting staff development in this area and helping colleagues in all disciplines, because of course assessment and feedback can look different in different ways, to find the right way for the most impactful feedback, which need not be time spent writing lots of commentary. And there's a balance there as well, I think. But again, it's investment in the model and investment in developing staff in those regards.
Yeah, and I can see how those what might appear to be small changes have such an outsized impact. I know from my own teaching practice that the advent of having a phone that had a voice note functionality on it was brilliant because I would just make a voice note and then it wasn't work, it was writing up. But I didn't have to think back. For me, the feedback is in the moment, both in terms of me thinking about it and also the way I like to receive it.
But can you imagine if in that example, just send the voice note to the student?
Oh, absolutely.
So the mode of receiving feedback, which equally could be in a 10-minute conversation on a Teams call, there are different ways of us conceiving of that interplay, that interaction with the moment of feedback that I think sometimes we've kind of hard coded to be one thing. And it's the student having to download the script with the comments, and it's hard for them to go back and speak to the tutor. Well, what did he mean by that? But actually, again, if we build into the model, interactions with the tutor to talk about your assignment, well, hey, that's rich feedback, and that's human to human feedback that is important for other things as well, like belonging and feeling heard and seen, all of those things.
Completely. I mean, if we take it out of the context of higher education, feedback is inherently dialogic. The idea that you'd write something and send it to someone feels very old world in that way. But it's I think that there's clearly a lot of potential here in the way that people do things. Sending the voice note, enabling people, giving them the systems to do that, I think is a big part of it. My last question in this episode is one that is. I acknowledge, I ask this to a lot of people, and it's incredibly broad, but it has a great advantage because it allows people to go wherever they want, which is, will AI transform or undermine assessment in education? And I can predict the answer is somewhere in between, but Ian, I'm interested in your in between and where you
So you've
sit.
worked out by question five that I tend to sit on the fence on most of these either-or questions. Well, I think it is both. I think it could undermine assessment modalities that are already fragile. And is that a bad thing? Well, I mean, I think AI will undermine weak assessment, and it will accelerate transformation of stronger assessment. And that might be a good thing. But it will be a good thing in the way I've just phrased it. I think it's AI hasn't suddenly created this challenge. I think it's exposed what was already starting to look a little bit fragile. And put really simply, if our main ways of assessing depend heavily on recall, production, routine reproduction of knowledge, or the isolated generation of a thing, the essay, a report, again at the end of a module, then of course AI, the advent of ubiquitous AI relatively raises very difficult questions, and that's precisely why this moment in the history of higher education is so important. Assessment is already changing, has already changed in many institutions, and is on that trajectory. I guess that the longer term question is back to that. Are we willing to redesign assessment regularly, constantly in those agile ways? And that also relates back to that thing about the human, what is genuinely the atomic human, as Neil Lawrence, a distinguished professor in the world of AI, talks about. What is left is as humans, and that needs us, when we design assessment, to have an emphasis on judgment, on ethics, critical thinking, creativity, synthesis. There's a thought. I mean, how many of our pathways and qualifications enable synthesis across a subject, let alone different subjects. And then the responsible application of knowledge in context, the authenticity thing we talked about earlier. So I think we have to accept it's not just a one-off transformation. We need to be much more comfortable with ongoing iteration and evolution. But I think if institutions and in fact individuals refuse to do those things, assessment will be undermined. So in that sense of your question, assessment will break under the strain that we're now working under. So therefore we have to be more flexible and agile in how we do that. So I mean, I think I will say, you know, there's a lot of negativity actually in the sector. It's all seen as a challenge. It's the fault of the technologists and big tech for landing this with us. Now, I mean, I've got colleagues at the OU who've been working on large language models as their scientific endeavour for decades. So we know it's not new. We knew it was coming. And I'm much more optimistic than negative. But with that optimism comes, you know, the pressure and the privilege to be trying to solve these dilemmas in real time for our students today. And sometimes when we're thinking about the future, the trick that mine plays on us, which is, well, that's in 2040, 2050. Yeah. You know, it's in the long grass. So we can be a bit sci-fi about it, but for now we'll stick to our exams. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, no, our students graduating now are already going into a world where AI is ubiquitous. And I think we have a genuine and really important responsibility to prepare our students for that in the way we teach, the way they learn, and the way we assess is absolutely central to that.
I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the things that you said in there is that looking at how we teach across subjects, for me, programmatic assessment is potentially the ultimate form of authentic assessment, because none of us think and do in our day-to-day lives in tiny little silos, bar, you know, people maybe who are in really specialist fields, but the majority of us have to synthesize all that we know. And there is another great opportunity for us to drive that authenticity and to drive, I think there's a potential for, if we look more programmatically at our assessment, that will also be a change lever and a driver that will force us out of a 3-hour exam. One hopes that what we wouldn't get is just two modules combining their exams and you get half the questions.
but don't forget as well, if in that context of programmatic design, we also need to remember some learners doing just a module.
Yes.
You know, the advent of the lifelong learning entitlement here in the UK is an important consideration. Other parts of the world would talk about stackable and micro-learning and all of that as well. You know, so there's a risk there that we don't provide opportunities to think across horizontally and to bring understanding together. So even in a module, there's other ways of, you know, synthesizing what I already know with what I've been taught now, synthesizing what I know in my world of work with what I'm now learning about this subject, synthesizing my prior life experiences, my life wide and my lifelong learning coming together in the synthesis is also really important, even if we're just studying for 10 credits at a time or whatever people may be doing. So, but I think that's a really interesting area in this regard.
Couldn't agree more. Well, Ian, thank you very much for joining me today and for the discussion. When I do these podcasts, I remind myself that I have the best job in the world. I get to speak to people.
No, I've got the best job in the world. I've got the best job in the world.
Okay. Well, that can be the subject of our next podcast.
That's the next debate. Yes. Okay. Brilliant.
Well, thank you again. And I want to thank our listeners for listening to the podcast, this and many other episodes. If you found it useful, please like, subscribe, share. If you've got a minute for a review, that would also be great. Thank you, Ian, again for joining us. And thank you to our listeners. Assessment in Focus is brought to you by Inspira, providing flexible assessment with integrity. I've been Ishan Kolhatkar, and I will see you next time.